Music is, in many respects, is almost like food. It's almost like air in many of the communities I've found myself in.
15 years ago, a bunch of brothers, friends, people from the ends came together and they were tired of seeing the UK talent overlooked. And they decided to build their own platform from nothing. And that platform became Mixtape Madness.
We contribute so much to this creative economy, but we don't really have that much of an economic stake in it. So I'm looking at information as in, but this record that's released, who owns it? Who's getting the lion's share of this income?
What started as a small like mixtape hub back in 2010 wow. has grown into one of the most important institutions in British music.
I'm not keen on saying stuff like, I made this person. It's like, nah, you're creative, you brought something to the table, I brought something to the table. The combination has allowed you to kind of amplify what you do. I'm at peace with is that the other person I haven't mentioned in that equation would be my wife. So I think your partner, again, is very, very important that you're intentional about making time with them as well.
And you guys started recently just developing artists on the Mixtape Madness, like Killer Wen, things.
And yeah, things like that. How I come? Mean,
welcome to another episode of Everyday Leadership, and today I have the pleasure of having a conversation with Krabbenar. What started as a small like mixtape hub back in 2010, wow, that's gone time, has grown into one of the most important institutions in British music. A cornerstone of UK rap, driving force to drill, a place where generations of artists have found their voices. And Krabbenar, also known as Quabs, co-founded Mixtape Madness alongside Kingsley, you had Eddie, you had Andy, you had Maz in the mix, and they didn't follow Blueprint. They created one. They gave the streets a home online where no one else would, and they kept that ethos of access, authenticity, and artist development at the center of everything they have done, and that has seen their platform explode. Today, Mixtape Madness on their YouTube channel has over 1.8 million subscribers, over 1 billion combined streams. And those numbers matter because they tell a very simple truth. Mixtape Madness is no longer just a platform. It is part of culture. It has shaped sound, launched careers, and documented a movement for a decade and a half. And today, we get to sit down with one of the people who built it. How are you doing, Quabs?
Yeah, I'm extremely happy to be here. So I take it I'm doing relatively well, and overall I just feel grateful.
You know what, it's mad just when I started going through. I have the fortunate, should I say, of knowing you guys and being friends, yeah, and seeing it build from way back when it first started out, and just to be here to celebrate like 15 years. When you first started out, did you think this is where you'll get to in reality?
To be honest, probably not, if I'm honest. And it's just been a journey of continuous learning. And continuous learning, I guess, especially when you come out of university, you're not fully aware that continuous learning will consist of life experiences far beyond academia. And in various ways, shape or forms, I've learned various aspects of business without necessarily picking up the textbook. So did I know that we would get to this particular point? Not fully to begin with, but maybe, you know, around year five, year seven, the vision was to definitely head in this direction.
Mm-hmm. Let's go way back. The name, Mixtape Madness, where did that come from?
Do you know what? Looking back on it now, I'll pin the name more down to Eddie. Do you know what I mean? Mixtape Madness. But the aim was to compete with DatPiff, which was a massive mixtape website in the US.
Yeah.
So essentially, we were just building a home for UK mixtapes. And mixtapes at the time was a great way for artists to show their skills, their arts and craft. and just give that to fans and build a way as a way of them building their audience. Mm-hmm. So you jump on mixtape, you may jump on beats that you don't necessarily have any legal ownership over, but you're giving it away for free. So you're making everyone aware that you're not monetizing this piece of content. Mm-hmm. And you're doing this on a regular basis. And I guess each time you drop a mixtape, you're meant to be kind of trying to grow your audience more and more. And mixtapes was a very pivotal tool for artists from that, I would say, UK rap, that road rap era, that, you know, UK rap era, just after, I would say, the grime generation. But time isn't linear, so of course there's a lot of crossover. Yeah. So there would be grime artists, of course, that would have had mixtapes. But I feel like their main training ground was more on the radio sets, the pirate radio stations that they'll jump on, and so on and so forth. Yeah, so in essence, that's where the mixtape part of the name comes from. And I guess the madness element.
Was the madness to start it?
Yeah, just probably describes the journey in and around that time. But either way, I do feel, the name was fitting for the journey that we'd gone on and the journey we were about to go on as well.
Think about that journey. We're talking about Datpiff, obviously huge in the US. In the UK, there was no one doing something similar around mixtapes. But then you also had Link Up TV, you had Jerem Daily at that point in time, who were the big, thriving platforms. So you bringing something brand new to the market, was there any doubt around, could this actually work? Or
no, I feel there was enough confidence in the fact that we had seen a lot of artists still handing out mixtapes in the physical format on the high street and so on and so forth. Thus, we believed that this would be a greater way for them to scale their audience in terms of... it would be a great way for them to scale their audience because their mixtape being online, it could travel further than them handing out mixtapes to a smaller number of people offline. Mm-hmm. And so we felt there was a business model in that respect, that we knew there was a high volume of artists. And, you know, you're from the community that we come from, so you're very much aware that music is a key part of the DNA mm-hmm. of the, not just the, I guess, the community we grew up in, but even the geographical communities our parents have come from. So music in Black culture, full stop, is very, very important, right? And often used as a way to... Music kind of personifies the journeys that cultures and communities or subcultures and subcommunities are going through at that moment in time in history, mm-hmm. if that makes sense. So we knew that from a creativity standpoint, we're not going to struggle to get content. And so the main aim is just kind of making sure that content is reaching a mass audience. And Link Up, GRM, SBTV, we knew that they were more focused on producing visual content, mm-hmm. where I guess our core focus in many respects has been more around the audio element. And so that audio, whether that being on mixtapes or the audio's been uploaded to YouTube and then we're just putting artwork there, so mm-hmm. people are listening to the mixtapes on YouTube, to us creating content where we're filming artists deliver their audio freestyles or moments, but we're making sure that the audio still sound good enough that you can listen to it in a party, or just other forms of content that we would have created. It would still always kind of orbit around artists and their audio creations. And so from that point of view, I didn't perceive those other platforms as competition per se.
Mm. And it's interesting when I listen to you talk, I'm like, typically speaking, people chase the shiny things. Mm. So the visual element is shiny. And people be like, let me double down
100%.
On that. Whereas what you were doing with mixtapes was more scrappy in a sense.
It's the more boring stuff.
It's more boring stuff. And you're like, 100%. No, let's lead into that and look what happens when you kind of double down on that. And you talked about music being part of our generation, part of Black culture. I'm curious, from your perspective, were there any artists or people that you looked at where you're like, oh, there's a lot I've learned from that, whether it's people you've just watched in the States or watched here over the years that've just kind of helped you, shaped you?
100%. I think on a domestic level, you know, it was Commander B, for example, would be someone that I would listen to back in the day. When I was going to college, my, you know, I would have my TDK, which to many young people now...
What's that?
Yeah, it's like an antique. But you'd have your TDK. I get home on Mondays. I'm listening to Deja Vu on Mondays. I would be listening to Heat FM as well. If I go to college, certain people might tell me what's happening in like South London with Delight FM. Mm. Like the internet wasn't in the way it is now. So there's many of these artists I'd be listening to. I don't actually know what they look like until I go to like Palace Pavilion or Stratford Rex to go and see these artists perform. On a US level, I would listen to a certain DJ that's kind of cancelled at the moment. I would listen to his rap show. I'd listen to his rap, but it's true. I would listen to his rap show to hear exclusive rap tracks.
Yeah, because that's only one we could actually get access to. Yeah.
Before they reach the likes of MTV Bass and so on and so forth. So that's what I was doing in secondary school. There's a mutual friend that we both know, and then when he first joined my secondary school, he was a massive Nas fan as well. So bouncing off someone like that, and then collecting music through that format was very, very interesting. And I look back on it, I have two parents that I love dearly, and they were great and amazing parents. But music, in another way, still acted as like an older brother in many ways, shape or form. Kind of informing, so you listen to some artists that could inform me about like social, political issues, some that are informing or, yeah, pointing me in the direction of having a good time, catching a vibe.
Yeah.
And I look back on it now, it kind of also gives me an insight into, especially like I said, the internet wasn't as prevalent as then, gives an insight into narratives in other pockets of the world / society and how they correlate with what's happening on my side of the world in my society as well. So I feel like music is, in many respects, is almost like food. It's almost like air in many of the communities I've found myself in.
Wow, it's powerful. And when I think about that analogy, I can definitely relate because there's so many elements in my life. When I listen, even now, you listen to certain tracks, it just takes you back
100%.
To those times and those moments. And there's so much wisdom that you got from it and learning and understanding where you might not necessarily gone through that experience, but you can get a better understanding and overview, which I guess it's deeper than the lyrics. It gets into your soul. And I guess you then taking that learning, thinking about what you guys created with that, okay, let's get more and more voices out there who are not being heard, which is where the mixtape element kind of comes from.
Yes, and then at uni, I studied economics and business finance as well. And I feel the thing that kept on prevailing in my mind was we contribute so much to this creative economy, but we don't really have that much of an economic stake in it. So I'm looking at information as in, but this record that's released, who owns it? Who's getting the lion's share of this income? And back then, it just wasn't the artists or the creatives in our community.
Mm-hmm.
So in my head, there's always been this concept of trying to democratize that and ensure that our creatives are being empowered in an economic way that is fair.
But isn't one of the problems that has been in place where there hasn't been, why people haven't benefited from it, is because the, let's call it the record labels per se, they're not actually looking at the culture as we want to empower people. It's more like we're just here to make money. That's been fundamental to what it's been all about. And then obviously a platform like what MM was great to democratize that. But then going back to the heart of it, to democratize something, you still need economics. for the first, what, 7 years that you were operating MM, you had your full-time job and running that. How did you manage to handle the economics of that?
I feel when you're truly passionate about something, I guess it doesn't feel like work. So it feels like this is just something I have to do. So those first 7 years also consist of discipline as well. So you know that you're getting money from your job, but the money that you get from your job, you try to like reinvest it. Then it gets to a stage where maybe it's paying for itself, but it can't necessarily pay for me.
Mm-hmm.
And then you get to a certain stage where you can afford to build a team. And I feel that building a team is the pivotal point. And that's the point where that kind of takes you over the line. And one thing I've kind of seen from a lot of creatives, even back then, is the reason they weren't able to scale or grow was their inability to build a team. And I know building a team now probably is harder than ever.
Mm-hmm.
But at that time, that I felt was the tipping point. And I think when you build an effective team, you want people that are better than you in your areas of weakness. And we had a small office in Tottenham, the 639 building. For those of you that don't know the area of Tottenham that well, the 639 building is literally opposite the Allied carpets that got burned down in the 2011 riots. So there's an iconic image of a building that's been burned down. That's literally where our office was. So that kind of paints the picture as to where the type of environment our office was in. And our office was like literally, no word of a lie, it's probably no bigger than this room. It was almost like a box. The office was, if you went to view a property and you think of a box room in that property, then you can think of the Mixtape Madness office. So it would maybe be a little bit bigger than a box room, but it'd be smaller than the main living room of a nice property. So, but in that office, I would say, you know, I look back on it, those initial team members were so pivotal towards the growth and the scale of Mixtape Madness. You know, the likes of Bilal, Oscar, Niall, Jeff, Fadumo, Gus. Those initial team members were so pivotal towards the growth and scaling of the company. Team members that followed afterwards, of course, were important and pivotal as well. But I think when you're starting a company, those first 5-10 employees can really, dictate the trajectory of where your company is going to, where your company's going to go in a nutshell. And the importance of that initial team, of your initial team, is in terms of scale, it means you're not having to do everything. So it's almost like if your company's a person, now that person could be at multiple places, having multiple meetings all at one time and addressing different aspects of the business. And that's where I'm saying when you build a team, you're complementing each other. One person's strength complements another person's weakness. And that's how it stays intact and it can kind of grow from there. But in building a team, you've also got to kind of understand and encourage your team members' growth and development. So as I'm learning in the business, I also have to ensure that my team members are learning as well. So like, there was like one random book I read on just the concept of a team. And then I loved the book so much, I was just so eager to just share it with the rest of them, if that makes sense. And that's kind of like been a bit of my philosophy. But then as I've gone on the journey, I think the value of support systems of a business is like fundamental and super important, that maybe a lot of us initially take for granted if we've got no experience in business or we haven't worked at certain companies and so on and so forth. And I guess that's what kind of made me realise, instead of me blaming these big corporations for where we're at, as a music industry, especially in relation to our culture, what things are we good at doing and what things are we not so good at doing? Do you know what I mean? So the actual creative element, which we deem as the most important part, and it is very, very important, do we sometimes allow that to eclipse other aspects such as HR, legal, finance?
The core fundamental structures of business.
And like, you know, even just technical IT support. Yeah. What does that look like? And I say, and even the last one, you know, people think like, why would IT support, or why does that become important? And it's extremely important, and it's something that a lot of, even now, a lot of artists, managers, or music companies that are starting up, they don't do. Do you know what I mean? Because it's just not spoken about. But for example, if you're starting a music company today, I'm advising you as a young creative, start finding a way to build your own data room. So build your own online data room that has all your contracts in there, for anything that you've used to kind of purchase user money, whether that's beats, whether that's creative content, and so on and so forth. You know, make sure your data room so will consist of, like I said, all your legal agreements. It consists of, the main thing is actually your legal agreements, but also consists of like your accounts. So all your relevant accounting information. It's a place where you store the stuff, the things that you create.
Mm-hmm.
So make sure that, you know, you've got, you're storing somewhere the tracks that you create, which includes the stems. If it's a visual production, somewhere to store your visual. And all of this, obviously, over time can become very expensive to build.
It's your IP, though, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
There we go. So that IT infrastructure is there to ensure that you're securing and you're locking down your IP. And that front, the value in that is so important, because I've come across now, there's so many artists that I've come across that might want to sell their catalogue, for example.
Mm-hmm.
But because they haven't got that data room there and they haven't got their IP in order, on paper, someone might tell them, your catalogue is worth £1 million. But for our due diligence, we need A, B, C, and D. They can't produce A, B, C, and D. There's no £1 million. Right? So that's why I say it's the shiny stuff, sometimes we allow it to kind of eclipse.
Yeah.
The so quote unquote boring administrative side, but it's that administrative part where our true value lies. And I'm not saying this to preach, because I've been burnt by it myself. Do you know what I mean? Like inefficient admin, and it's like, this has come to bite me in the bum. So I say this now so you don't even make mistakes that I've made. And yeah. So taking a back step, even when I'm talking about the HR side, yeah, that's talent spotting. Because I've told you, your first employees are imperative. But once you've got that talent through the door, making sure that you're following the legal HR guidelines to ensure that the service that you're obtaining falls in line with the legal requirements of this country. And then beyond that, how am I developing the talent that this person possesses?
Where are you learning all this from? Because like you said, you're brand new to the game.
Yeah. So I think, like, a few stuff. So previous jobs that I may have had, I'm watching how those jobs and those ecosystems work. So I'm like, okay, they've got like a HR function here. What does this HR function do? And so on and so forth. I feel in terms of the finance side, for example, prior to doing Mixtape Madness, Showpiece used to find me really, really annoying.
I didn't even know.
Showpiece used to hate me. Ah, because I was doing the CIMA accounting course, and I used to, there was so many, because I'd never studied accounting before. Like, I didn't study accounting at uni. So there's some basic concepts I'm just not really understanding. And I'm hearing out Showpiece, because I know Showpiece is a bit of an accounting guru. But fair play to Showpiece, he would always respond and come back to me. I was like, this guy must be fuming. So, like, even through that experience, it was still invaluable. It kind of made me understand the benefit, like how to read a P&L, how to read a balance sheet, which means if I ever engage with accountants, I know what conversations I should be having with them. Because that's the other side of it. I think you can get services in play, But if you hire an accountant and you don't know the right question to ask them, or you're not engaged with them, then they'll provide you a service, but only to a certain point.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you still need to proactively be engaged in that process. And there's so many creatives, they're like, oh yeah, nah, I had an accountant, but my finances have gone wrong. And they're trying to blame the accountant, but I'm like, no, you have not been an active participant in the management of your financial situation,
yeah, which should
be, yeah, and that's meant to be your priority. They've got many clients. Their priority is to kind of just submit your accounts and so on and so forth. And even understanding the different roles within that, an accountant is very, even within accountancy, a tax accountant is very different from a royalty accountant,
mm-hmm.
right? A royalty accountant is not the same person that works in necessarily an accounts payables or accounts receivables or credit control or does a treasury function. Does that make sense? But because if you haven't been exposed to that, or you haven't done your research on it, or you don't have the knowledge on that, you're trying to hire someone that could do all of that stuff,
yeah.
but not acknowledging which aspect is their strength, which aspect is their weakness, or even if they're legally allowed to offer you that information, you're saying to an accountant, like, so many art creators I work with, and they'll be like, why am I paying so much money in taxes? And I'm like, I'm not a tax accountant, so I'm not qualified to advise you on that. They'll go to the accountant, and they're like, the accountant will be like, I'm not a qualified tax accountant, so I can't even legally give you tax advice. So if you're paying too much on taxes, you have to procure the services of a tax accountant, if that makes sense.
It does, but then, I mean, it's perfect sense, but in my head I'm thinking, if you're talking to an artist who all they have is the name accountant,
yeah,
and they don't know the differences between the various types of accountants you might need, as an example,
yes,
and you're trying to educate them, in their head, wouldn't they just be thinking, this person just trying to bamboozle me and take my money, so, yeah. Or did they actually listen?
No. So in my head is, to anyone, is I'll just explain it, and I will obviously give my opinion on a matter,
yeah.
But I have to make it very clear, I am not a qualified tax accountant, and I respect that someone has done their 10,000 hours to understand how to navigate the tax system, so I can make suggestions, but I have to put that disclaimer in there. And I guess in certain, depending on what type of hat I'm wearing, I can connect the dots and put you in contact with the right people. Mm. But yeah, people charge for their services. If you don't like the price, that's a whole different conversation. But I labor on that point just to kind of say that it's okay not to understand, but you have to make it your business to understand, because it's for your business, in a nutshell. And it's these boring, like, it's these quote unquote boring aspects is what in the long run will kind of define the survival rate of your business, or if you even have a business, if that makes sense.
Yes.
So, I feel like my degree wasn't in accounting, like I've said, but now I know about accruals and the importance of having accruals. So even like to anyone that's done studied accounting, that's just basic. But if you're not from there, you're like,
it's not your world. So it's you don't even have the language. You don't know what you're looking for.
Exactly. At all. But understanding that, and I think once you understand how those support systems work, mm-hmm. it's transferable across other business verticals and so on and so forth. And then you can have more business-to-business conversations with people outside of your industry.
You mentioned how critical those first 5 or 10 hires were. And you said one of the things you looked at was like trying to find people who were in different areas or skill sets to you. What other qualities were you looking for when you were hiring that helped you build that foundation that MM has been built on?
Yeah, I guess the qualities I was looking for consisted of like someone that's got very close to what's happening on the ground, right? Because I'm aware a new generation's coming through. Who's got the ear for that new generation? And really is passionate about music that's emerging from there and can kind of bring it to life. Who's passionate about marketing this sort of music and then bringing that sort of art form to life? And who's passionate about a company? So these first employees would have heard of Mixtape Madness as a website.
Yeah.
And then they've come on board to try and take it to that next chapter. Then I had another A&R who was very meticulous about how music sounded and, you know, the whole studio process and the kind of like the engineering process and sonically how projects kind of fit together and came together as well. And that skill set that he possessed at the time was invaluable and super, super helpful. And there was also an element of just them being creative entrepreneur, having a level of entrepreneurialism themselves, which I felt that they displayed. Like the young lady who was helping us with marketing, she had, I felt that, yes, marketing was one skill set, but she also had entrepreneurial ideas in helping to build, take the brand into new spaces. Or there would be having the idea of we're now, I don't know, we're shooting music videos, but then let's birth our own freestyle products. Mm. And just the level of innovation is something that you look for, innovative, like people that are like really, really innovative and on the ball and they're passionate about the business. So in a way, they kind of fill in some gaps. They're suggesting like this person's good for the company to collaborate with and build with and so on and so forth. And so I feel it's people that you look for, someone that's like hardworking, innovative, has that kind of creative spirit and creative drive. But I'll be honest, at that early stage, I feel all of us were kind of like martyrs. We were all martyrs. And
what way?
I feel like there was this element of like no days off. There was just that level of hunger. There was a level of hunger that can't be replicated or it can't be manufactured. I feel it's innate. So I feel when you've got that level of hunger and then you mix it in with innovation, hard work, and consistency, you're going to see some good results. You'll see some good results.
How do you balance that hunger, no days off, grinding, while still also having a family like you did?
100%. And I guess one thing I'm at peace with is that balance is a bit of a fallacy,
100%,
but it's still good to strive for it. And comparison is the theft of joy.
Mm.
Like there's so many times where I have to just know my own check balances and kind of see, is this actually aligned with the value I'm meant to be bringing in this situation? So there might be times when I've gone to a studio session, everyone's in the studio, they're doing what they're doing. But I've told myself, no, I actually want to make sure that I'm doing school drop off in the morning. So I'm going to leave here relatively early, but it's not hindering nothing if I leave it relatively early, because the team that's here in place, they're more than competent to make sure that the required result gets delivered. And I feel it is making those commitments. And in a way, there's multiple commitments at play here, right? There's, even when we're talking about balancing family life, I think a family in itself, you're operating a business. And it's a very difficult business to kind of operate. But the bigger and bigger your family gets, and bear in mind now I've got four kids.
So that's you got a big family.
Yeah, so that's six human beings effectively. So there's so many things that I'm supposed to do that I don't necessarily do. And it's like, but I do it for my business. How am I not doing it for my house and so on and so forth? But realistically, yeah, you need to be plugging those numbers into spreadsheets now because your family is that size. But being intentional for creating moments as well, and not necessarily understanding some. Initially, when I'm about to create a family, I'm thinking I didn't get to travel until I was like 17, 18. So going on holidays is not that deep.
Mm.
And I guess that's where the music side has helped me as well, is that I'm learning a lot of the challenges a lot of young men in particular have gone through in their childhood, thus entering adulthood. And it's also taught me, like, right, these things that we think are normal are not normal, and the effects can be extremely adverse. How do I prevent this being the portion of my children.
Yeah, breaking that generational
hold
that we kind of had over the
years. So one thing I saw is, like, for example, traveling for a lot of these young artists was really invaluable and actually did change their perspective, because many of them had rarely even stepped out of their estate, for example. So, and so I guess when you've got a family, you've got to be intentional. Like, you know, we need to try to put in some holiday time. And that holiday time doesn't have to even consist of leaving a country. It might just be going to another part of the country, or even going to stay with family that just live in an area that's nowhere near your area. Just that change of environment, change of scenery, creating those intentional moments with your family, like, is priceless. But doing that on a consistent basis, and that's why it's even something little as taking them to school in the morning at that time of my career was, like, really important to me, because this is where we're having priceless conversations. And I remember having priceless conversations with my parents during that period of time. But like I said, when you've got a family, you're not only building relationships with your family as a whole, but you're also building a family with, you're building relationships with various individuals within that family as well, because every individual in that family has got their own specific needs that need to be catered for. Like, none of my children are the same. Mm-hmm. So you've got different strengths, different weaknesses, different anxieties, and different things they relish in. So it's almost like you got to be intentional in trying to kind of address where they're at as well, and meet them where they're at, and not spend so much time away from the business that they grow without you even realizing. Because children grow so quick. And I think that's a driver for business as well. It's like, the speed at which children learn and grow is this rapid. What am I doing in between that time? Mm. And I guess the other person I haven't mentioned in that equation would be my wife. So I think your partner, again, is very, very important that you're intentional about making time with them as well. And that one thing I've learned from, I guess, being in a relationship is that you can actually get lost in just being a dad and make it secondary that you're a husband as well. And you're almost kind of taking your wife or your partner for granted. And I definitely have been guilty of that. And I'm grateful that my wife has kind of tolerated that aspect of the journey. Because, like I said, you know, you're coming to do Mixtape Madness, and she's given that the, no, look, I believe you're going to be able to do it. So me quitting my job, which at the time would have looked a bit ludicrous.
It looked a bit.
Yeah.
It was crazy, bro.
Yeah, crazy. Crazy. Work. Crazy. So me quitting my job when I know I've got a child on the way, but she's still there kind of being supportive in that process. And then she's kind of seen me just work all hours around the clock to kind of make this work whilst trying to be a first-time dad. You know, little things like changing nappies, to going to understanding the learning process in nursery, or that first day of school, like just those little moments, trying to be intentional with those moments. There was probably an element of time where being an intentional husband wasn't my forte. And I guess what marriage has also showed me is I haven't been the best in necessarily even also communicating my frustrations or my feelings, which is something that with time you have to work on. And it's, I think the, and that's why I come to that point of balance, is like, even when your relationship reaches a place where you think you're sweet and everything's good, that's at that moment in time, then, you know, you can kind of maybe sometimes get complacent,
yeah,
and unintentional, and it's just that kind of coming back to the drawing board. Mm. And that's why I say maybe in many respects it is consistent. There's many aspects where family and business kind of overlap. Like, yeah, you have to, on a regular basis, be engaged with your work team, your work employees. On a regular basis, you have to be engaged with your, you have to be intentionally engaged with your family, mm-hmm, that's your children, and your wife. So you've got to be intentional as a husband, you've got to be intentional as a father, you've got to be intentional as a co-founder and I guess director of a business as well. And then in finding that balance, or like I said, balance is a fallacy, but trying to kind of strive for more balance, I guess that's where trying to be more intentional with your time and planning your time becomes even more important.
Yeah.
Where maybe when you've got no children, you're just like, yep, this is it. I'm grinding super hard. And I tell all the young entrepreneurs that I see now, like I spoke to one at a video set on Wednesday, and I was telling the young man that I respect what he's doing and he's going hard and he's grafting, but he has to think of tomorrow. He has to think of what does my exit strategy look like, right? In terms of right now, you're super passionate, you're going hard, you want to dedicate all hours of the clock to this, but at some point, don't lose yourself. Like, you still need to maintain the connections with your family. You still need to one day think about if you want to build your own family and what that looks like. And when you do get to that position, you don't want to be thinking about that at that moment in time.
Yeah.
You would need to be in a position where you've been intentional about your planning, carving out, getting to that stage where you've carved out enough time to enjoy other aspects of life. And the environments where you've come from, you know, it's almost as if we're told, like, our manhood is defined by our ability to make money.
Mm-hmm. Provision is the pinnacle.
100%. All the time, yeah. So then when we get to 2025 and then, you know, we're reading, well, in terms of the black community, I guess, we're reading certain articles that are saying, you know, on average, black women are earning more than black men. Then many of us are confused about, you know, what our role is in society or what we're meant to be doing. But we haven't taken time to maybe analyze, was that always just a bit of a negative way to look at it? Like, was it negative to look at our position in the family as just strictly one where we're responsible for providing financial resources and then that's it? Like, we can sit on the TV sofa, flick the remote whilst the rest of the family, or whilst, you know, our partners take care of the rest of the family. Was that really meant to be the script? So, again, just looking at it from that point of view and just encouraging people you come in contact with, whether that be in our family or in our workplace, that we need to realise there's definitely more to life than just trying to chase a check. And let's enjoy this process. Mm. Enjoy the processes that we're going through and make sure that we're learning and growing from these processes as well.
I think that's the biggest thing. I think I like the way you put it. I always say that for me, the biggest lessons I learned a lot came from being a husband and a father. And I took that into work. And it's always in and out, because you can't just focus on one area and be like, okay, I'm going to be this personality in one space and that personality just doesn't work. And you're just going to tear yourself into two and you're just going to be absolutely tired and burnt out. But if you can start to integrate and be very intentional, I love that word you use over and over again, be intentional around it. And I don't believe in balance. I always use the word harmony, recognizing there's ebbs and flows, like the seasons. It's how do you blend those two elements of your life together? And having someone that you can communicate with, talk to, if you can keep them communicating all the way throughout that process, especially when you have an amazing partner, it makes a massive difference. I think so many times, especially when we lean into that headspace of we are providers, we're like, oh yeah, I'm doing this for the family, so why do I need to talk? And it's like,
yeah,
well,
it's crazy.
That might help you.
Even the amount of creatives where I've had to kind of break it down, and it's just like, they're like, yeah, but I spend this amount of money. And I'm like, no, like, not every life issue boils down to your level of financial contribution. Mm. Like, there's other contribution that your partner may be looking for that is a bit absent.
Mm.
But what I will say as well is that space is also good. No, it's also good. It's still good to be your own individual as well.
You need it.
Yeah, no, but I think it's just a good reset. It's like, let's say you've got a partner. If you're with your partner 24/7, what's there to really talk about? You go away for a little bit. You get your own space. Let's say part of the day, you're going through your own life experiences. They go through their life experiences. Maybe it's pickup time. You pick up the children who have gone through their life experiences. Then you break down those experiences you've gone through. when children go to bed, you and your partner break down the day mm-hmm. that you guys have had. Kiki. And then on to the next
100%,
step.
I agree.
So I think space is also important. So in many respects, that's why when you talk about ebbs and flows, it's true. And it is good to also be fulfilling yourself as an individual.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think it's also a good life lesson for the whole of your family. And the other thing I'll say as well that I think is important is comparison is the theft of joy. Do what works for you and your family, as it were. And I think too many times people are looking at other people's situations and they're comparing it and they're allowing that to make them feel depressed or less than. And that's not the case. Do you know what I mean? Comparison is the theft of joy, and certain things, to a certain degree, the reason why we've accomplished what we've accomplished is down to our own hard work, is down to our ability to navigate. But no, there's also a certain element that just boils down to, some people call it certain privileges that fall in our favour. Some people just say down to just God.
Mm.
Do you get what I'm saying? And we have to have that level of humility and understanding that not everything was just purely down to I. Some, you know, part of the reason why you accomplish things is due to, like I said, your team,
yeah.
And which is why I say it's important to build a team. Partly down to your family, which is why it's important to, you know, build with them and pan with them. And there's another element where it's just due to forces beyond your control. And like I said, we can say that that's God. I know there's other people, you might define that something else. But whatever you define that as, just know that it's not all you.
Mm.
It's not all you. And I think it's really important to kind of take that on board and kind of ground yourself in that space as well. Because I think, and that this week actually, it's been a bit of a thought on my mind, because you know, I've seen the horrific things in that Diddy documentary.
Mm.
But I guess the part that kind of really stuck with me was just more a case of, on a much smaller level, not on the same level, but on a much smaller level, do I understand, or have I seen examples of how creatives or business owners get to a headspace where they can intentionally disregard like the value of other people? And then I tell myself, yes, I can see how people get to that place, because they get to a stage where they actually believe in their own grandiosity. They believe that it is all I. So it's almost like they start to develop a bit of a God complex. Do you know what I mean? And it's important to see divinity in yourself, don't get me wrong. But no, this is not all you. Do you know what I mean? There's so many different facets that have contributed to you getting to this place. But the minute where you believe it's solely I, then for me, that's when you can reach a place where you can justify doing some very, very crazy things.
Yeah, that's when the ego's fully owned you. Like, you're like, I'm the one. I'm the 100%. Man. I'm doing this. I'm self-made. Exactly. All that kind
of
talk.
So we do understand the importance of ego.
Yes.
Don't get me wrong. And believe it. Because even to be a successful entrepreneur, to be even a successful creative, it requires a lot of self-belief.
Yeah.
Because you're trying to do something that, you know, I've seen creatives where it's like, if you're being rational, you're not going to do this.
Mm.
Well, if I'm being rational, I'm not going to go into Mixtape Madness or try to set up a business. So there is an element of ego that is important. But like you said, just when it goes all the way to the other side of that spectrum, Houston, that's when we've got a massive problem.
I guess that's where you're also good to have people around you that can check you.
Yeah, 100%. And, and that's why I say those
enablers.
Yeah. And that's why I'm saying those team members are important. That's why family is important.
Mm.
Family will provide you that. With the G check, like, you come home and it's like, no, you're not that whatever they're telling you in that magazine,
leave it there,
or on that TV show, you're not that guy. So don't think you're coming in here trying to act like that. Do you know what I mean? Even your children will humble you.
One time.
Like, daddy, turn that off. Or, do you know what I mean? And it's almost like, you see them people that will say they've gone to a parents' evening and no, their child has drawn a picture of them at school and it's a picture of them holding the phone. Mm. And then it's just like, the parent will look at it and be like, wow, this child has literally just told me in a very polite way, I'm spending way too much time on my phone instead of spending time with them. Mm. Do you know what I mean? So even like when some children be like, daddy, are you on Instagram? And I'm like, oh, no. Do you know what I mean? No, you know what? Maybe I actually need to intentionally, there's time to just put the phone away, lock it up, hide it, and then just spend time with the family. So just there's little indicators where family and your workplace can humble you. Like, all the teams I managed in the past or at present, of course, they can talk to me openly. And even when you're having those one-on-one reviewing sessions, part of that one-to-one is, let me know what I can do better, or let me know ways in which you feel I haven't necessarily supported you in A, B, C, and D. So on a quarterly basis, I say that loosely because there's certain people I catch up with a lot more frequently than that, depending on where they're at in their career. I try to lock in these one-on-one sessions where we are going through how they've performed for the quarter, but also how I've performed in relation to them.
So you're also getting that feedback from them.
Yes, I'm getting that live 360 type of feedback from them. But like I said, I think it's important because it just prevents, you going all the way on that side of the spectrum. And I think one thing that's super important is just self-awareness. Because self-awareness just allows us to realise, self-awareness, I think, allows us to hold ourselves to account as well and realise this is my strength. This part here might be a bit of a weakness, as it were. And in that respect, I'm even more fortunate because I also have my brothers for that as well. So, for example, after we finish on this podcast and it comes out, I'll probably send it to them and then they'll be like, this, W, that was a bit an area where you could have improved on, for example. So,
speaking of ego, when I think about some of the iconic series you guys have launched, Mad About Bars, The Cold Room, Next Up, which have launched like so many artists coming through something like that, do you ever look back and be like, we did that? Like, we have launched what? Onomt, Diggity, Moncho, like so many of the names I could list with like millions and millions and millions of streams just coming through those spaces that you guys created through Mixtape Madness.
Again, I more look at it as I'm grateful that I've been able to provide a platform for these artists. I know that a lot of creativity has come from them. And we just provide you a platform to amplify that creativity. That's why, even when in terms of language, I'm not keen on saying stuff like, I made this person. It's like, nah. You're creative. You brought something to the table. I brought something to the table. The combination has allowed you to kind of amplify what you do and take it to another level. That's a blessing. Congrats. Do you know what I mean? And even if we're not working together tomorrow, I'm still happy that I played a part in taking you to this point and moving on from there.
Oh, it's a very humble.
No, I think it's just life. I think, like, for example, you own a business, you employ staff. Staff could be doing super well, super great. One day that staff member decides to leave. Mm-hmm. Why do you see that as a personal attack? Like, they're leaving because maybe they feel that they've done their time here, they want to try a new experience, and so on and so forth. If there is something that, you know, they were unhappy with on my side, give me that live feedback. But ultimately, I do genuinely wish you the best, and I'm happy for what you've contributed here in helping us get to where we need to get to. And then I guess my job from there is to find someone that can help take it to another level to replace that person. You're with a family, but you accept one day, you know, your children are going to grow and become adults, and that you have to respect them as adults in the decisions they make, even if you disagree with those decisions, right? And then you allow them to leave the nest. Does that make sense? So why would I have a different mind frame with regards to a creative artist? A creative artist has come through, they've leveraged the platform, they might take it to another level, and then they choose to go, you know, somewhere else after that. I'm happy for you, I'm grateful. That's what this platform's here for, to help you elevate and take it to another level. So, yeah.
You guys started recently just developing artists on the Mix and Madness, like Killowen, things.
I think through our whole lifespan, we've always been developing artists, and we just don't really sing about it or make it like public news. So even in relation to Killowen, for example, we wouldn't, our whole focus was, he's got a song where he raps at, in fact, let me take a back step. He's got a song where he raps about Tesco to a Tesla. And I remember when we, you know, first signed him, that's where he was working. And just seeing where he's taken his career. So I think it was like back early, was it early 2023? Mixtape Madness had signed him. And then it's only in 2025 where he's got a song that's actually even a mass chart success. But that chart success, people might think like, oh, right, this guy just popped up from nowhere. But no, he had been working hard all the way back, even before we had met him. But when we met him, just seeing him develop the attention to detail in terms of his artistry and then the team working around him to help him amplify that, for me, that was, like, extremely inspirational. And now, so just seeing his growth trajectory from 2023 to 2025, I'm like, this is what it's about. You know, it's deep and it's trying to get a quick viral hit or a quick viral moment. It's when you look back on your career, it's like, how many other careers have I helped empower to kind of grow and elevate? And I feel when it's all said and done, that's the element that will kind of give peace, bring peace to one.
So when I listen to you talk about MMA, it reminds me of what I call the old school A&R, where they spend time really investing in their artists to, like, this is the business, this is how you do things, it's not overnight success, it's not the flashiness, and you guys are really embedding that educational piece into the people that you work with in all the different aspects that they come across you to ensure that they actually elevate and do better. It's not about just stay with us, but it's like, no, we want to make you better artists, creatives, business people,
100%,
and elevate that on a consistent basis.
Like, we were arguing with artists about, because I think I remember it was just so difficult to get financial statements or understand what costs were being applied to artists. For one artist that was in a deal, so I was like, no, we don't really want to operate like that. So just live in real time, like, we're talking to artists and their teams, these are the invoices that are coming through against your project, like, this is the budget we've got in place. Let's try to stick to that budget. We're starting to go over budget. This is how you're performing in relation to the budget. Like, you just try to have these open, transparent, frank conversations with creatives and their relevant team, because effectively, in many respects, they're your business partners. Do you know what I mean? You're partnering up to kind of launch products that you hope will be successful during that time you're working together. Some are short term, some are long term relationships. But even regardless, in that situation, your business partners, whether it's short term or long term, to try and make sure that product is successful.
Where do you see things going? I mean, mixtape, you've got the mixtape still. You've got series that you've launched, you've got editorial pieces, you've got partnerships you've worked with, like E-World Cup and different elements of that, and big brands. You've had a label and a partnership where you had a publishing deal out there as well. You're having artists come under your banner. Like, what's next?
Yeah, I feel the music industry at large is in a very interesting place. And I know, you know, AI is the two buzz letters.
What are your thoughts on that?
Well, my thoughts, I think AI technology can be used in a way that complements what creatives are doing, and provided the IP for artists are protected, sorry, not just artists, but the IP for, you know, all creatives. So when I say artists, I'm speaking about producers, and just all creatives are protected in that process, then AI can be used effectively to amplify what creatives are doing. And there's many creatives that already use AI tools to kind of help, let's say, the production of certain beats, or plugging in certain, sorry, for even, sorry, certain plugins and so on and so forth. AI technology is being used by creatives, right? Mm-hmm. So I guess the scary element is just when AI technology is manipulated in a way that it's abusing artists' IP or creatives' IP. And I feel, regardless of anything, though, whether I feel AI is good or bad to some degree is irrelevant. AI is here. The disruption is here. So as creatives within this industry, we just need to be aware of how we're going to navigate it and use it to our advantage to further boost the careers of artists.
I like that. Because I think it's like, what's the point of you complaining about it, moaning about it? Yes, people are signing multi-million record deals, but if the tool is here and it's going to be used going forward, how do you leverage it in the best of your ability? Mm. But to your point, actually, but still keep on pushing for the fact that no protection is key. Because you can't, what people are using is their God-given talents to kind of get out there and then to be able to just use a system to then get the same level of music. Even what we just talked about, that Killer Wen, like, that's a couple of years of grinding and then some to then have a, be married that up with a AI produced kind of similar vocal pattern going out there in the world. You don't want that to compete at all.
Yeah, look, where, you know, you read an article here that says Universal Music Group has done a deal with UDO, or Warner has now done a deal with Suno, and Suno is now valued at, over £1 billion. And so that's why I'm saying these things are happening. So it's already here.
Yeah.
So it's just important that we understand how we're protecting ourselves in this process and leveraging it to our advantage. And the other element of music that I think is really, really important is the live music industry. And we know that there's a lot of small venues that have been struggling and closing down. And I feel it's just important as an industry we find a way to kind of reverse that trend and just really remember how important live music is to the careers of artists at the early stages of their career.
What are you most proud of?
That's a good question. And I don't think I've applied that much thought to it. But ultimately, yeah, I'm just proud that we have managed to kind of create an economy for many creatives in our industry, or what contribute to an economy for many independent creatives within our industry, from recording artists to producers to videographers to people that just design artwork, to entrepreneurs in fashion, to entrepreneurs that have their own production companies, to entrepreneurs that we've met that own their own space. Like, I feel I'm just extremely proud of what we've been able to contribute to the economy of creative entrepreneurs and creatives at large in the UK and beyond.
One thing I would say is that will you, Kingsley, Eddie, have consistently kept on doing is the ethos you had at the start of, like, keeping the artist at the center of everything that you do, all the way to the last 15 years, you've never deviated from that. And there's been ups and downs and changes and different bits and pieces.
You get peaks and
troughs. But you've kept that consistent value all the way throughout. Yeah. And every single person that always talks about MM is like, no, like, they keep it real. Everything they're doing is not, like we've talked about, it's not about the ego, it's not about the pride. It's always around centering the artist. And they will be open, they'll show you the book, they'll show you everything that's going on. And it's all about elevation. And 100%. They are one of the good ones in the business. And it's 100%. Such a rarity to hear some people say that in music on a regular basis.
Do you know what? It's interesting because it's like artists or creatives can, there's so many of them that could just reach the owners of the company and have, you know, frank conversations. But there's certain spaces they'll go into, they don't get past the first floor. So, it's refreshing.
Yeah, it's more than refreshing. It is intentional. And I think that's the word I'm going to hold on to. It's everything that has been built has been intentional. 100%. And you guys have done it consistently. And it's great to see you like celebrating 15 years. It's great to see you guys getting your flowers. 100%. And get your flowers while you're here. I said, like, MM is an institution. He has built so many artists, so many people, so many industry people, not just even artists. Like I said, a lot of people behind the scenes have come through MM. Like, internship here, there, come through, get some experience, learn about the business. So for me, it was just great just to hear a different side of MM and lean into that and celebrate what you have all built. And there's so many more years.
100%. A lot
of successful 100%. Years.
Yes. So, yeah, look, thank you for having me down here. And I guess before I do leave, let me know what you've been up to.
I'm building out here. You know what it's like? You know what it's like? I'm just growing my company, growing my exec culture and growing my leadership development. Because like we just talked about, our leadership piece is key. Whether it's personal or professional, the more we can actually get people to think very, very different around their leadership, the better humans that we create and the better people that we have in our environment, and that kind of multiplies and that grows. So being able to do that through mindset shift and then have the podcast to talk to amazing people like you and learn from and also elevate what you're doing, that for me is what my legacy is all about.
Beautiful. I love that.
Thank you very much. You're welcome. Really appreciate this conversation. This is Everyday Leadership. We'll see you next time.